The following is a Poppy Chulo Radio original program. The views and opinions expressed in the commentaries and or interviews of the following program are solely of the individuals and are not the views of Poppy Chulo Radio, its parent, affiliate, or subsidiary companies.
Wyatt O'Brien Evans, starting in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Greetings and welcome to another episode of The Woe Show. I'm your host, Wyatt O'Brien Evans. I trust your weekend was simply marvelous, just marvelous. My Woesters, I'm really jazzed about tonight's program. You see, an exceptionally accomplished individual who's impacting the LGBTQ community in such an awesome way is visiting the Woe Show. And the gentleman's not even 30 yet. Dang! Just who is this guy? Well, he's Mr. Corey Yarbrough, co-founder and executive director of the Hispanic Black Gay Coalition, which is headquartered in Boston. But before we jump into that, a couple of things. First, I have a question. What's all the rage? Well, it's my new novel, Nothing Can Tear Us Apart, Rage, along with a thrill-a-minute storyline that will grab you by the balls, in a good way, mind you. Rage is so freaking sexually hot that your small, medium, large, or supersized soldier will pop up and salute. Hell yeah. Visit my online home, WyattEvans.com, for excerpts and more information. And secondly, Miss Cuntish Cumshot is on travel this week. Yeah, she's on travel. You see, she's doing research for her upcoming book. Its working title is, and now let me get this right because I don't want to mess it up. The title is The Texture, Viscosity, Fluidity, and Absorption of Cum. How to fully understand and therefore better use cum for your extreme and ultimate pleasure. All I can say is freaking yowza. Now, I'm proud to have Mr. Corey Yarbrough up in the Woe Show house this evening. Mr. Yarbrough is a learned and outstanding individual who's making one hell of a positive impact within the LGBTQ community, particularly its Hispanic and Black populations. And as I stated before, he ain't even the big 3-0 yet. And he's got one heck of a resume. Check it out. Following graduation, Mr. Y completed the Bill Emerson National Hunger Fellowship with the Congressional Hunger Center. Afterwards, he worked closely with the National Coalition for the Homeless to expand the organization's civil rights agenda. And in doing so, he sparked national attention to violence against individuals experiencing homelessness, and he launched a national campaign to register homeless and low-income individuals to vote. In 2008, Corey moved to Massachusetts to work as a community organizer on a campaign for state education reform. Then in 2009, he was program manager for Let's Get Ready, a nonprofit organization that provides low-income students with free SAT prep and other support services. And in that same year, Corey co-founded the Hispanic Black Gay Coalition, HBGC, with his partner, Mr. Quincy J. Roberts. Now, HBGC takes a comprehensive approach to meeting the mental, physical, social, and spiritual needs of its constituency. In 2012, the organization was honored by the AIDS Action Committee for its innovative work in HIV prevention and LGBTQ empowerment. And in 2013, Mr. Y was featured in 50 Black LGBT People Every Black Youth Should Know, which is a list compiled by the National Black Youth Pride Services. Now, having said all that, God, I'm so tired. I'm just so tired. And I'm sweating over here. I'm just kidding. The Woe Show welcomes Mr. Corey Yarbrough. Talk at me, my brother. How the hell are you?
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate that intro. I didn't think you were going to read it all, but it sounds great.
Well, actually, I didn't read it. I memorized it, Mr. Yarbrough.
Wow. I'm even more impressed. Thank you.
Yeah, that's right.
It's good to be here.
So how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I'm doing blessed. It's been a hell of a week, but I'm glad I'm near the end of it and I get to have this opportunity to talk with you today. So thank you for having me on.
Oh, listen, it is my pleasure. I mean, because I want to thank you for coming on. And Corey, I wanted you on tonight because of your absorbing personal story. And also, man, for the fact that you're making such an impact within our community. And that's what the Woe Show is all about.
Awesome. Awesome.
So what I want to do first, Corey, is before you take us down and through your remarkable career to where you are today, mm-hmm. let's travel back to your beginnings. So where were you born?
I grew up in Norfolk, Virginia, which is in Southern Virginia, Navy town as well. So I grew up there pretty much my entire life, all the way through high school. So that's where I'm from, the 757.
That's cool because, you know, I'm a native Washingtonian, so we're not that far apart, actually.
Yeah, and I spent some time in D.C., so yeah, both feel like home to me, so.
Cool. Now, Corey, I like to ask my guests this question because, for one thing, it's fun, and then secondly, it's rather telling. So here it is. Just...
I'm nervous.
listen, you know what? As Judge Judy would say, don't try to figure out where I'm going.
Okay, you know? I'll give up.
Don't even try to figure out where I'm going. So anyway, Corey, here's the question. Just what was Corey like as a boy? And give us some juicy details. Come on now.
Wow.
Yeah.
Boy, oh, there's different phases of Corey as a boy.
Okay, we're waiting. But... Come on.
The first thing I actually thought of was as a kid, and even now, but I was obviously more obsessed as a kid. I was a huge Janet Jackson fan, and so you know, I was that guy who had the posters, the all the magazine covers all over my room, and so that's what I think of first when I think of my boyhood, and actually how like that you know, in many ways was a period in my life where. I began to question manhood, or my manhood started to get questioned just based on that obsession. Like, is he into her because he wants to be her, or because, you know, just,
your anthem was Control, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, that's what boyhood was like for me. But as far as, you know, Corey, the student, and in middle school and in high school, I was a really shy kid. I was kind of always cautious of my surroundings, and I kind of just wanted to fit in and just, you know, pass my way by. So it's kind of weird now to be considered a leader, to be, you know, doing what I do today, because I was really that shy kid who rarely spoke up in class, you know, growing up.
Well, you know, we had that in common as well, because when I was a kid, I was really very, very shy. And in high school, I just broke out of it. It was really interesting. So mm-hmm. I definitely can relate to what you're talking about. Now, Mr. Yarbrough, let us fast forward to you preparing to enter college. And mm-hmm. when I've read this, I was kind of blown away. You actually enrolled in Jerry Falwell's Liberty University. Let me finish. And you did that because, and I quote, to pray the gay away, end mm-hmm. quote, and that's pretty heavy. Mm-hmm. Would you mind telling us about this and about your experience at Liberty?
Sure. I mean, I think really, you know, that story also goes back to my childhood and growing up as a boy. Because very early on, you know, I felt like I received messages that being my authentic self was not okay. And it's funny because I got it not even so much explicitly from my parents, but through so many different angles, be it the media, be it through the teams I was on when I played sports, be it the church, and all in the school. So all these different things, you know, made me think that being gay was just simply not acceptable. And not only was it not acceptable, but it was my burden to get rid of it or to hide it. And so, yeah, it's weird because when I was in high school, junior, senior year, you know, so many people look into colleges based on, you know, a location they want to be at or a particular program that they want to study. But for me, one of the main priorities was finding a college that could, quote unquote, fix me or make me this ideal Christian. And being an ideal Christian at the time meant being straight. So I remember researching a few religious colleges. I was also trying to afford college through a debate scholarship. So I remember those were the two things. I wanted a school that had a debate team, and I wanted a school that was Christian focused and was conservative in Christian focus. And lo and behold, Lynchburg and Liberty University came on the map, and you know, I applied, I got in, and you know, I went through that journey, and really a good part of it quietly, because my parents didn't even know that that was one of the reasons why I selected the college. And so a lot of it really was this internal dialogue and oppression going on with me just trying to fix myself silently and connect with other people on campus who were trying to do the same thing. And so that was a year-long experience, and it was hell to sum it up. It was also one of the most confusing times in my life, as far as receiving mixed messages from hypocritical leaders who want to, you know, help you pray the gay away one second, but want you on your knees for another reason later on that night. So, you know, as a youth, that can be really traumatic. And obviously it didn't work. and, you know, I was able to get out and just get around positive people who appreciated and celebrated me for who I am.
Well, let me ask you this. That is really heavy, because I'm still trying to get over that. Were there actually other students there who were trying to pray the gay away as well?
Yeah, I remember connecting with men who were in my class, and I was in this almost like a Bible study group where and I still have the book to this day. I bring it in every now and then when I speak to you for other people. Sure. And the book is called Every Young Man's Bible Guide. And so we would study this book that was about sexual immorality, and then it had Bible verses and daily meditations based on that. And so I remember one guy in particular who I'm still friends with, that we were kind of like the accountability buddies, and we would try to hold each other accountable for giving into our temptations and struggles. And so it was more informally like that. And, you know, at Liberty University, I'm not sure if this is still the case right now, but if you were to be open and visibly gay and proud of that and living authentically in that, you could get expelled for that.
Wow.
Or you could be seriously reprimanded for that. And so it also added another element of shame to it, where you really couldn't be as vocal about your struggles in that area, especially if you wanted to do so in a way that was affirming and wanting to like live in your truth. So yeah, that's what that experience was like for me.
Corey, how many people of color were at Liberty University?
Oh, geez.
There's a few there.
So, for example, that accountability buddy that I was just speaking of, who I'm still friends with, he was black. He is black. and very few. And it was even more isolating for me because, again, I was there on a debate scholarship, and I was definitely the only black male, and I believe the only black person on the debate team. And so, you know, and being on a debate scholarship required putting in a lot of time and effort into the sport. So it was really, really isolating. I also remember going to mandatory convocation services that Jerry Falwell would preach at three times a week, that being required, and, you know, being one of the only black people, you know, in the arena that it was happening in. So Definitely dealt with a lot on both ends, from the racism to the homophobia and the internalized homophobia, you know, that was pressed upon me from being in that culture.
You know, Jerry Falwell 3 times a week. I mean, that's overexposure. If you were to listen, if you were to look up overexposure in Webster's, you would see Jerry Falwell's face.
You have no idea. It was such a frustrating time. And I was there doing the Bush-Kerry election. So it wasn't even really preaching, in my opinion. It was just really sermons on why you should vote for Bush. And it's just I just feel like it was an institution that that intentionally brainwashes people. I remember taking a class on Old Testament law, and literally you had to take the test as if you believe certain things, and you had to almost outsmart the test by saying, oh, I know they want me to give this answer, and I need to give this answer to get this particular type of grade, even though you may not personally believe it. So, you know, that was really a crazy time, but why I'm so passionate about the work I do today, because I wouldn't want anyone to experience that if they didn't have to.
Wow. Okay, now you're in Jerry Falwell La La Land, as I call it. and at some point you had a major revelation that totally altered your life and put you on a different path. Would you tell us what that revelation was? How did you come to it? And how did it affect you?
Yeah, you would think it would be this grand story or something that just happened to me one day. But as far as what made me transition out of Liberty, I honestly just was surrounded by love. And I had some great friends and allies, both white and black, most of them that I'm still close with and friends with today, that, you know, I did confide in, and they did accept me. And it was the first example while being at Liberty, I feel, of like unconditional Christian love, or what those principles are supposed to be all about. And so, you know, there were a few special people that were in my life that convinced me that, you know, that wasn't the journey that I needed to take, and that I could just be me authentically. And so those people and those allies, you know, kind of supported me on transitioning out and going on to James Madison University and, you know, being really, really happy there.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Let me ask you this. When did you come out to your parents?
What happened with that? Okay, so I originally came out to my mother in high school. Actually, I was dating this guy at the time, and it was one of those things where I was asking for rides over to his house and sleeping over his house every weekend. And finally, it just got really, really suspicious, really suspect. Mm-hmm. and one day I remember she was driving me to school, and she just asked me, you know, why do you always hang around this boy a lot? And I believe, I can't remember the exact words, but I think she was like, you're not gay, are you, or something like that. And then I was just like, well, what if I am? And then I, at the time, just came out as bisexual. I'm like, oh, well, I like both. You know, I'm really into people, not gender. And, you know, it was kind of a hush-hush thing. It was like never again mentioned after that conversation in the car. I was scared to bring it up again. And I think my mother just didn't know how to continue the topic with me. So I essentially came out as bisexual and then like ran back in the closet and didn't want to talk about it anymore. And so it really wasn't until really moving to Boston that I kind of brought it back full circle. And the turning point for that, and when I came out to my father, was the suicide of my brother. Was really, really close to. We're only 2 years apart. Grew up together. Mm-hmm. And that was the moment for me where it was just like, you know, life is precious. Life is short. We have to chase our happiness. We have to be our authentic self, because it can literally kill us. If not through suicide, you know, how we take all of that stress out on our own bodies. So I wanted to be honest and upfront with my parents about my sexuality, because I also want not only to free myself, but I wanted them to know their son. I think it was a shame that there was so much mystery around my brother's suicide, as if we truly didn't know who he was and what his struggle was. And so, right. I wanted to at least, you know, create a path for establishing that with my parents before, you know, they leave or I leave. So.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. The whole coming out process can be very difficult. It really can be. Okay. So you earned your justice studies degree. Now, after that, Corey, would you walk us through your career path to where you are today as, you know, with the Hispanic Black Gay Coalition?
Sure, sure. So, yeah, I graduated from JMU, justice studies degree, and I kind of wanted to immediately get some hands-on practical experience doing social justice work. And so I applied and enrolled in this fellowship by the Congressional Hunger Center that you mentioned. And that was really my first time being on the front lines and doing grassroots activism and and getting involved in different social justice projects. You know, with this particular fellowship, it was focused on anti-hunger and anti-poverty. And so that was an amazing experience. I got to spend time in Pittsburgh and D.C., worked for the National Coalition for the Homeless in D.C.
Wow.
So it was a really quick way to get my feet wet and to get some solid experience that I still carry with me today. But after that fellowship wrapped up in a year, I was looking all over the country for jobs. The economy was crazy. And so I was kind of just letting the universe direct me. And I was like, wherever I get a job that I'm fairly passionate about, I will move wherever it is. And Boston was it. So I moved up here to take a community organizing job doing state education reform. Campaign was successful, but I wasn't happy with the communities I was organizing in, which were more so white, middle to upper class. There's a town here called Gloucester, and if anyone's listening from Massachusetts, you know exactly what I mean when I say Gloucester. It's almost like Lynchburg and Liberty University.
Oh, geez.
As far as being all white. But it wasn't what I got in the game for. I wanted to work with people who looked like me, who I could relate
sure.
to, and who were struggling. And so, you know, I had a career change and kind of focused on direct service, still in the education field, you know, supporting people, helping people get into college who were first generation college students. And, you know, while all of this is happening, I'm still trying to adjust to Boston as a Black gay man.
Sure.
And, you know, my partner and I, Quincy, we were very early in our relationship on dates, and we were just complaining about how much we hate Boston, how, you know, we go to events and we're the only ones in the room. And it feels like we're either being tokenized or we're just being flat out rejected and, you know, no one's checking for us. And so we had that moment where it was just like, well, why don't we do something about it? And I remember looking at him like, what do you mean? Why don't we do something about it? Like, what does that even mean? And then, you know, we kind of realized that we both have amazing experience. His background was in political fundraising. Mine, as you heard, was in organizing and programs. So it was an interesting marriage for creating an organization. And we just did it. And we got some friends who were also invested in helping us get it started. And it just kind of grew and grew and grew. And I think that speaks more to the need and how hungry this community was for an organization that was specifically by and for a particular community. And so that's kind of the origin of the organization.
That's fascinating. That is totally fascinating. Corey, tell us a little bit about your position as HBGC Executive Director, what you do and how you do it.
Yeah, good question. That it's a lot. It's a lot.
Okay.
So as Executive Director, one of my major priorities is fundraising. So I write a majority of the grants. I help cultivate donors. And just help build relationships so people know who we are, know the impact we're having in the community, and are compelled to help us out in any way that they can. So first and foremost, you know, that's my job, is to just make sure the organization is sustainable and is growing and is visible in the community. I think after that, I also I'm the only full-time staff member at HBGC. So you know, hopefully down the line, the executive director won't wear all these hats. But
sure.
I also, you know, serve as a program director to a certain sense, in that, you know, I guide my team. in coming up with goals for their programs, strategies for meeting those goals for the programs, and then just providing the resources necessary to have those programs and groups succeed. So that's also something I'm really passionate about, because I enjoy professional development and working with people in a team. And so those two are the main responsibilities of my job, but it seems like it shifts from day to day doing different things, but that's also is what's exciting about it.
Oh boy, that's a hell of a lot right there.
Yeah, oh. It keeps me going though. Hopefully it keeps me young. I guess only time will tell there.
Well, you ain't 30 yet, so you know.
Yeah. True.
Okay, so I take it then one of the challenges that you face is raising funds for the organization. Mm-hmm. Any other challenges?
Oh, absolutely. Raising funds for the organization is a challenge. But I think, you know, obviously in Boston, racism is very real. All different types of isms is real in Boston. And so that can be very challenging as well. And of course, it's all tied together, because it can be difficult getting funding because of the type of organization we are. But I feel like running an organization like this, there's so much to balance, right? Because we have to deal with racism from the mainstream LGBT community and the Boston community at large. We have to tackle homophobia and transphobia in the Boston community, and our particular mission is to do that within the Black and Latino community. So that's a challenge before us. And in addition to that, we are the Hispanic Black Gay Coalition. So that means we work to unite the Black and Latino community as well. And so that can bring challenges, particularly in Boston, where it's not like where I grew up as much, where those two communities are naturally drawn together and kind of see each other as one as far as the struggle. That's been a challenge within itself, as to have Latino leaders invested in our mission, have Black leaders invested in the mission of merging the two communities. And then on top of that, you have the lesbian, bisexual, gay, and transgender community, which is in our mission statement, and I take very seriously as far as making sure we're as inclusive and representative of the entire community we claim to represent. And so that's a lot to juggle, and that's a lot of relationships to build, and a lot of healing and mending in our community to make. And so I think that is a challenge as well. But the funding piece plays into that, because all of those dynamics kind of affect how you're able to get funding. So, yeah.
Wow. Now, Corey, you've touched on this before, but I would like you to expound on it. Why are you so passionate about working with the Latino and Black communities?
Good question. I think there's two, we'll see how many answers come out, but I think there's two answers, main answers for that. The first is that simply the Black and Latino communities in Boston were the two major ethnic and racial communities that did not have any representation at all. So when I say no representation, no organization, no LGBT organization solely invested in empowering those communities, no visible or very few visible leaders who were Black and or Latino. So that's like the simple answer. It's just it didn't exist. Whereas for, you know, some other ethnic and racial groups, those LGBT organizations did exist. So that's one. But two, I think where the passion for it comes is just looking at the statistics and, you know, across the board from HIV to high school dropout rates to homelessness to depression to suicide. It's always, or 9 times out of 10, it is Black and Latino LGBT people, or Black and Latino communities in general, fighting for the top spot with those disparities. And so I feel, because all of these social ills are particularly impacting the Black and Latino community so deeply, we have to work together to find a solution and to really uplift ourselves to be that solution. And that's why I'm passionate about that. And, you know, I think it's the crabs in the barrel syndrome where people try to divide and conquer, right? So they try to turn black people against Latino people because, you know, you're claiming they're taking our jobs or they're doing this and they're doing that. But really, that's just a scare tactic to keep us all oppressed. And I want us all to realize that and to work together to be that change and to implement solutions for our own communities. And I think we can also do that while also embracing other people of color and realizing that this is about creating a coalition, but specifically working with like-minded communities who are faced with common issues. So that's why the Hispanic Black Gay Coalition was created to do that.
I can tell that you were on the debate team because that was a hell of an exhaustive answer. And I'm not complaining because you did it beautifully. And I really, really appreciate that. And your passion just came out, you know, through that entire answer. Let me ask you this. It's my understanding that though HBGC is not just a youth serving organization, it has a lot of youth and leadership development programs. Let's explore that.
That's something I'm constantly exploring for myself as well. And I think naturally, at the time, at least, both co-founders, we were under the age of 30. And so I think naturally it was just who was drawn to Corey and Quincy in the organization. And that tended to be youth and young adults, young professionals in particular. And so I think because we had that crowd around us as we were starting the organization, a lot of our initial programming reflected the people who were at the table and who were most passionate about doing the work to get it off the ground. But I do think it is important, though, that HBGC has youth development initiatives and that a majority of it is youth development initiatives, because that's part of our sustainability, not only as an organization, but as a community, right? So we have to be able to equip the next generation with the knowledge and the skills, the confidence and the passion to continue on this work, because, you know, we're all going to have to pass the torch to someone eventually. And so we want to be there to provide that support. And so that's why I'm passionate about youth development in particular. And, you know, beyond that, you know, again, all of the statistics that we talk about are disproportionately impacting black and brown youth of color. And so I want to be able to be there to offer support and, again, to do it in a way that is by and for our community. And so I'm very cautious about replicating this idea that white people have to come in and be our saviors, or we need to you know, beg white leaders to let us have a seat at the table. I want to be that example to show the next generation that, you know, you can create your own damn table. You don't need to beg to be at anybody's table. And through creating your table, you're going to start to get invited to their table sooner or later. And so I want to instill that in the next generation while also creating opportunities for intergenerational support. So even though a lot of our programs are youth focused, they do engage older adults. For example, we have an LGBT mentorship program where most of our mentors are over the age of 40, who are mentoring, you know, people under the age of 21. And so it, from the outside in, it may look like a youth organization, but it's more intergenerational because we have the older generation providing that wisdom and resources and knowledge for the younger generation.
Well, all I can say is true dat. True dat.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yes. Now, Mr. Y, I love calling you Mr. Y.
That's new. That's first for me.
Yeah, then listen.
I like it, though.
You like it? Now, listen, I patented that already, so, you know, that's mine. You can borrow it. I won't charge you anything.
Okay, but I appreciate that.
No problem. Let me ask you this. I've been reading where HBGC is one of few LGBTQ organizations that focuses on spiritual care and growth. Mm-hmm. Why, Corey, is that important to you personally? And also as an LGBTQ activist?
Mm-hmm. Wow, yeah, great questions. I mean, you know, obviously my story of just having gone through that experience going, you know, to a school and just trying to pray the gay away, writing down scriptures on index cards and putting them around my dorm room, and just going through that experience, you know, showed me that I wasn't alone. And there's continued to be a lot of people struggling with that. And I think LGBT organizations don't take that on enough, because I think it is paramount to where a lot of our trauma starts, you know, based on religion and faith. And so I just wanted an element of that in the organization to just acknowledge that it's real and that it's out there and that it happens, but also to show a different side of it, and to show that there are some affirming spaces of faith. And we actually have a partnership. Our office is housed in the basement of a Black church, actually the only historically Black church in Boston that wow. is affirming to LGBT people, Union United Methodist Church, where I also attend personally. And so we want to be, again, raise the visibility of affirming faith communities and affirming Black and Latino faith leaders, to show that, you know, if you want to be religious, if you want to practice a particular faith, that's not necessarily in contradiction with being openly about your sexual or gender identity. And so that's why it's so important to me, because I think so many souls and so many lives are lost battling with that. And I think it's based on a bunch of lies, a bunch of bullshit.
Yeah. Absolutely. Corey, I'm gonna touch on something that I'm very passionate about, and I'm sure you are as well. As a journalist, I've researched and written extensively about intimate partner violence and abuse, or IPVA, mm-hmm. within the LGBTQ community. And I just had an episode on the WO Show specifically about that. And also, I conduct seminars and workshops on this issue. Now, not long ago, HBGC released a report on IPVA within the Black and Latino communities. Would you mind stating some of the findings and tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. Yeah. So that report was a part of a collaboration that HBGC is in with three other agencies here in Boston, and it's called the Todos Initiative. And we basically exist to raise awareness to the fact that partner abuse, intimate partner abuse, does happen in the LGBT communities, and particularly within the Black and Latino LGBT communities. And so part of doing that was releasing this community assessment, where we got over 250 responses from our community, just about how you view partner abuse, your likelihood of accessing services if you personally was experiencing partner abuse. And what we found from that survey was interesting. First, you know, what stood out in the survey is how powerful our stories can be in transforming our communities. About 80% of the respondents said that hearing personal stories from those affected by partner abuse would be helpful for understanding more about what partner abuse is and why we should take it seriously. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that also complemented 55% of people who said that partner abuse is rarely or never talked about in their community. And so, you know, sometimes what seems simple is really one of the best approaches to meeting a need. And so just simply sharing our stories and being more visible about the pain our community is experiencing and the journeys our communities have taken towards healing can be very transformative and helpful in our community. But beyond that, some other things I thought were interesting that came from the survey was particularly around the question on what will prevent you from seeking support services if you were personally experiencing partner abuse. And at the top of that list, was confidentiality. So also, you know, still a great fear and stigma around mm-hmm. and who can you trust and who can you not trust, and how is that going to impact you down the line? But some other things that were interesting was that 51%, so over half of all of our respondents, said that fear and distrust of law enforcement would prevent someone from seeking support services if they're experiencing partner abuse, which shows us that this is more than just about partner abuse. This is about some greater social ills and stigmas and discrimination. Just the fact that if you were experiencing partner abuse, you wouldn't call the police because you don't trust the police. You know, I think says a lot as our community about where we are with our criminal justice system and how, you know, we don't feel safe within our own, you know, with law enforcement and with a system that is supposed to be designed to protect us. You know, 53% said discrimination from service providers, and 55% said that a lack of cultural understanding would prevent them from seeking support if they were experiencing partner abuse. So it's going to take a multifaceted approach to serving our community in this area. But I feel like it starts with making providers more aware of the unique experiences of Black and Latino LGBT people. Helping to shatter some of these barriers that exist, and providing different mechanisms and options for reaching out to support, you know, for support.
Let's see, Corey, you're absolutely right, because so much of what you said is what I found, you know, during my period of research, which is, you know, constantly continuing. And there's this mentality that a lot of people have that intimate partner violence and abuse is okay because it's boys being boys. You know, they don't take, you know, a lot of people, not meaning to generalize, on the outside looking in say, oh, you know, they're guys and they're boys being boys and it's okay. But it's not. Abuse is abuse. It's potentially life threatening and it's demeaning. And I just get so sick of hearing this. Oh, boys will be boys.
Yeah, I agree. You know? Yeah, I agree. And reminded me of a conversation that one of our groups had earlier this week, where we were talking about early messages of masculinity, and how as boys we were often told to be strong and to man up and to not be a wimp and a sissy. Mm. And so I suspect, and not even suspect, I can speak from my own experience, that when we get in situations of sexual violence and intimate partner abuse, for me, I often felt like, oh, I had to be strong, or dealing with this is part of being a man, or being strong and being able to process and work through whatever emotions that I'm having. And so, I think that's very real. I also think it's very real that people blame themselves. That was big for me. So I felt like I kind of deserved the way I was being treated or what happened to me because, you know, I chose this lifestyle or because, you know, I'm out here looking for love in the wrong places. And so I think there's a lot of self-blaming, that we need to support people to work through. Because it's not their fault. And there's lots of people out there who can support you, who have been in the same situation and can support you in getting through.
Mm-hmm. And I want to emphasize to our listeners out there that IPVA, intimate partner violence and abuse, can happen to anyone regardless of size, mm-hmm. strength, race, ethnicity, income, sexual orientation, or gender. It can happen to anybody.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Y, why do you believe that there is a need for more LGBTQ organizations operated by and for LGBTQ people of color?
Yeah, that's so important to me. And it's really important to me because I see what kind of goes on, quote unquote, behind the scenes. So it's frustrating for me to know that decisions about our communities, decisions about particular strategies and approaches to meeting a need in Black and Latino communities are made by a room full of white people. And the thing is that there's a lot of stunts and shows going on where there may be the illusion that decisions are being passed down or being made and passed down by leaders who look like you. But in reality, they're being done by people in closed doors who are writing checks or who hold power to make those decisions and have the power and the resources to have other people pass down those decisions who may look like you. And so to know that and to have experienced that and to have been excluded from some of those conversations, again, as one of the only Black LGBT organizations in Boston, and to still be excluded from those conversations and decision-makings is really frustrating to me. And it really concerns me because people are dying, you know. People are literally losing their lives over people who want to be selfish or who want to get a name for themselves, or who just wants to look out for their own community. We just really need to create our own table, as I said before. We need to build the resources of our community so we can minimize the need to engage other people who we feel are opposed to our values and opposed to our mission. And I think the only way we're going to do that, again, is by pulling together the resources of our own community. And yes, that means money. And yes, that means, you know, funding. But it also is what I talked about earlier. It's just passing down skills and knowledge for the next generation or for people in your own circle. So they can be empowered to make decisions and pursue their dreams without feeling like they have to compromise themselves. So ultimately, I'm passionate about more LGBT organizations of color because I want to see us implement the solutions to our own problems. I want our stories to dictate, you know, how we respond as a community and how we engage each other as a community. And I think that gets really compromised when you have to take funding from a certain person or you have to build a relationship with a particular organization because in the long run, it is supposed to help your mission. And I just feel like that's a form of oppression. That's a form of compromise and violence against ourselves to have to compromise a part of yourself just so you can get your community ahead. And I don't want people to experience that.
Man, you really hit the nail on the head. May I make a deal with you?
Sure.
Okay, this is the deal. I'll let you use Mr. Y if I can use stunts and shows. I love that.
I don't think I can claim that, but I do, you can definitely take it. I don't think there's a problem with that. I don't know where I got that from, but sometimes, yeah, that's all you can say. It's just stunts and shows, and without having to tell stories, I'll just leave it at that to keep it cute.
I mean, that's the headline for my next Huffington Post article, Stunts and Shows.
I love it. Oh, it's a lot going on. It is a lot going on.
Wow.
But yeah, I try to stay above it, and you know, I try to be honest about that stuff going on, but not dwell on it so much that it keeps me from doing what my mission and what my calling is. So that's what it is.
Well, Corey, let me ask you this: what's the next act or acts for the Hispanic Black Gay Coalition and for you?
Good question. So I'm really excited. We have our annual youth conference is coming up in October. And so this is going to be our fourth year doing it. It is something that started really small. It started with, I think, like 75 LGBT youth of color about 4 years ago. And this year we're expecting over 300 all over New England. And so that is going to be on October 4th and 5th in Cambridge. You can check out our website for more information on that. But that's just an opportunity for LGBT youth of color under 25 to come together in a space to exchange skills, exchange knowledge, celebrate one another and build a movement for what they feel like our community need to focus on. And so it's free. It's a great time. It's one of the largest gatherings of LGBT youth of color in New England. And so I definitely encourage you to check it out. Even if you're not from New England, you're welcome to come. Check out our website on information on that.
Wonderful. Corey, this has been such an enlightening and important conversation, and I'm so glad to have you. Let me ask you to tell our listening audience how to connect with you and communicate with you, your website, Facebook, Twitter.
Sure, however you can find me, it's fine with me. Maybe, I think I'm going to regret saying that. But no, I'm pretty much on everything. So you can find me on Twitter at CEO Yarbrough. I'm also on Facebook, Corey Yarbrough on Facebook. Our website for the Hispanic Black Gay Coalition is www.hbgc-boston.org. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on everywhere. My email address is on the website. So I definitely encourage anyone out there to hit me up, especially if you're looking to start an organization or you're looking for support in anything you want to do in life, particularly in the LGBT or social justice field. I think I could be of resource and would love to be of resource. So just know that you can connect with me for support. You have support out here.
Wonderful. Mr. Yarbrough, thanks so much for coming on the Whoa Show.
And my man, sister, thank you.
You have an open invitation to come back anytime you want.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Listen, thank you very much. And Mr. Y, it was a pleasure.
All right. Thank you, Y.
Take care.
Take care.
That's it for tonight, y'all. I'll be back next Sunday night, 9 p.m., same bat time, same bat channel. And just take a trip to my website, which is wyattevans.com, for all things woe. And you can also follow me on Facebook at the Wyatt O'Brien Evans Official Fan Club. And, of course, hit me up here at the Woe Show at poppychuloradio.com. So until next week, I'm a ghost. I'm out.